Well, Gregory Heisler admits that the process of making a portrait is fraught with unease. The subject, he says, doesn't want to face reality. For the photographer, that's all there is. Greg Heisler has spent a quarter century photographing covers for Time, Life, and Sports Illustrated. He has a new book out, Gregory Heisler's 50 Portraits. Inside is a collection of subjects ranging from O.J. Simpson to Joni Mitchell, Michael Bloomberg to Carl Lewis. Greg will be speaking tonight at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art, and what an honor to have him here. Greg, welcome to Kansas City. So good to have you here.
It's an honor to be here. Thank you.
Well, the making of a portrait is fraught with unease, you say.
That's an
understatement. Like it would be that way. Why?
It's an understatement. I think because for the subject, it's like a bad trip to the dentist without the happy gas,
really?
Basically. Yeah.
Yeah.
So they're all nervous about it. They're uneasy. And yet, as a photographer, you have an agenda of what you're looking for out of the photograph. And there's this kind of there is this funny push and pull where you feel like you're trying to elicit something,
yeah.
And at the same time, the subject's kind of got both hands up.
So and they're nervous tricky. About what, do you think?
I think they're nervous about just about being seen, honestly. I mean, for photographers, one of the things I do when I do a lot of teaching, and the first thing we do is actually have the photographers be on the wrong side of the camera, because that's a huge learning experience.
It is amazing to me. Sometimes you take portraits of folks, and they're so tight, so close up, that you're seeing virtually the pores in your subject's face.
Yep.
And I always wonder, boy, I'm not sure I'd be comfortable with that kind of photograph.
Yeah, you know? I mean, I think that actually, again, another thing we teach is the photographer to subject distance is a huge thing, because past a certain point, you sort of have to be yelling to the person. And if you're closer than a certain point, you kind of have to be in love. So
yeah.
There is that happy medium, you know?
Well, you say in the introduction to this absolutely stunning book you have out, Gregory Heisler's 50 Portraits, that you turn into Dr. Hyde when you're working. And this is what you write here. A funny thing happens when I get behind the camera. I become possessed, you write. No longer myself. Hyde takes over. He sees an image in his head and will do anything to get it. He cajoles and wheedles. He jokes and charms. He stalls and fumbles. He compliments and lies. He pushes. What does that mean? He stalls and fumbles. He compliments and lies.
I don't really lie.
Too late. You said
it. It's out there. It's in print.
Yeah.
I think what happens is I'm desperate. I'm a desperate person. I have this image in my head. I have to come back with it. I can't not come back with it. So basically, I'm on autopilot. Things just take over. I am possessed. And basically, if charm doesn't work, fibbing works. If fibbing doesn't work, pushing works. If pushing doesn't work, then you just resort to sudden physical violence that's unexpected, like, kind of like whatever you have to do to make it happen.
Well, I was struck by that. One of your subjects here in this book is Hillary Clinton.
Yes.
And you're granted a short amount of time, I'm sure, in the White House. And I was wondering, in a case like that, when you have to work quickly in a space that maybe you're not completely familiar with, how do you develop an image in your head ahead of time of exactly what you want when you haven't been to the place where you're shooting her?
That's actually a fantastic question. And for me, that's part of the excitement about what I do, is that some photographers photograph exclusively in the studio, and that's what they do. They do portraits in the studio and do a beautiful job.
Yeah.
99% of my work is done out on location, kind of with the control of the studio, but bringing it out like in a little bubble out onto the location. And the locations are endlessly fascinating. They're endlessly frustrating. They're full of funny surprises that you don't expect. But they're also endless things to pull off from. I mean, you walk into the White House. I'd never been to the White House before.
Yeah.
And it's really big. It's really fancy. And all of a sudden, there's like, wow, I get to take a picture in the White House. Mm-hmm. And Hillary Clinton's going to stand still and smile for me. Do you know what I mean? That's like, wow, that's a huge privilege.
And in this case, if I recall your story correctly, this all worked out pretty well, because she was wearing a color and a dress that was very conducive to a very nice portrait of the First Lady.
It's when the photo gods are smiling on you.
Yes.
All the colors happen to work out. Everything's nice. She was very charming. I had photographed her once before at her home in Little Rock. When President Clinton was governor.
And tell us how she greeted you in the White House then.
Well, that was actually funny. In Little Rock, she had she remember the whole thing was she doesn't stay home and bake cookies? So she had baked us cookies. That was number one. And then the White House would have been the second time I'd met her. And the first thing she said, and again, I don't care if somebody was holding up a sign behind my head, the first thing she said was, "Greg, it's so nice to see you. How are your daughters?" So that's it. I'm floored.
Yeah.
You know, she owned me from that moment on.
Yeah. And how did you go about composing sort of on the fly then that portrait of Hillary Clinton?
What happens usually in those assignments is I'll have a stand-in. It might be It might be Hillary's assistant. It might be my assistant. It might be someone we grab, an unsuspecting bystander.
Yeah.
But basically, we'll pull someone in, and I'll frame up the picture, get the camera set, and get it all ready so that by the time she comes in, it's kind of a done thing. I can't actually start scratching my head once she's standing there. I kind of have to have it all figured out.
So you had some lead time then before the first lady arrived to sort of get your bearings and figure out what might work here and what might not work.
That's almost the most important thing creatively for me, is I kind of really fight for my setup time. I might have 2 hours ahead of time to just be scratching my head and pacing around and getting nervous and having an aneurysm about the whole thing. But basically, it's that prep time that's crucial. Even if I only have 2 minutes with her, as long as I have my time ahead of time, I have a game plan. I know exactly what I'm going to do.
You know, one thing I really loved about your book and beyond the portraits were your stories about how you made these photographs. And very down to earth, very fun stories to read. You talked a minute ago, Greg, about these unexpected moments. Well, one of those unexpected moments, I believe, was when you photographed Muhammad Ali. Mm-hmm. And you were with him at his farm in Michigan, if I'm recalling correctly. And again, it's one of those photographs that most of our listeners will recognize if they see it. We have a display of his pictures on our website, kcur.org today, and folks can go take a look. But this particular photograph was shot outside in a field, and you write in the book this was shot in the late afternoon, but the effect of the photograph is that it was later in the day than that, and it's cold. I mean, it's really cold. The champ is standing in snow, and he's clearly cold. You finished shooting him, and you hopped down from your ladder, and you noticed that Muhammad Ali was sort of muttering something to himself. What a great moment. You ran over, and he was saying, obviously dealing with Parkinson's, you run over, and he was saying what to you at that point?
He just sort of smiled, looked at me, and said, "You love what you do, man, don't you?" And that's
and
a moment
crazy
you live
too.
For.
Yeah.
Oh, right. He said, "You're crazy, man. You're crazy. That's right.
And he clearly got the sense that he loved what you were doing.
Yeah, and he saw Hyde. Do you know what I mean? Like, there we were in the freezing cold. I'm up on a ladder. He had to pace 300 yards from his house in the freezing cold to get to this point. I hop up on a ladder. We take pictures for a few minutes. And I come down, and he realizes, this guy's nuts.
Yeah.
You know?
But Greg, why Muhammad Ali in a farm field? I mean, what got you from the boxing ring and then his home to this freezing field in Michigan?
Well, it's an interesting question. That sort of is when I'm on autopilot. I can't honestly swear that it's a conscious thought process that I'm aware of, that I guess basically what I was trying to get across was the sense of his isolation inside his own head. He has this trauma-induced Parkinson's, and he's kind of locked up inside his head. And I was trying to get a sense of that quiet isolation, and I was walking around looking for what the next picture is going to be, and I was pacing around farther and farther and farther from the house out into the snowy field. And you know, when you're in a field of snow, it's just dead quiet, like really dead quiet. And it just seemed like this perfect kind of isolation and a perfect place for him to be.
And so you saw it and you thought, I'm going to do this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is it.
The great portrait photographer Gregory Heisler will be speaking about the evocative portrait at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art tonight at 7 o'clock. More information about this event, asmp-kc.org. Again, tonight at 7 o'clock, we'll put a link on our website for this event. You can go to kcur.org, just look for Up to Date, and you'll find more information about Gregory Heisler's event tonight at 7 o'clock. You know, another picture, photograph in here that, again, I remember so well. A lot of people will remember this great shot of Mick Jagger in bright yellow and Tina Turner in black leather, taken together, a shot of them together, taken backstage at the Live Aid concert in 1985 in Philadelphia. Take us backstage. How on earth did you get them together for that moment?
That was one of those ones where you're sweating bullets, basically.
Boy, I bet.
I showed up there. There was nowhere to set up. They weren't
expecting
us.
You had a hard time getting in, I think.
Couldn't even get
in.
Yep, had to talk our way in.
Because these were rock gods who were flocking to this stadium, and everyone wanted to be there.
Exactly. And we were there, and it wasn't like we were walking around with a little snapshot camera. I had one of those cameras where you put the cloth over your head, and it has the big bellows on a tripod. Yeah. So a humongous camera like that.
Because
why? And a truckload of gear. It just, for two reasons, actually. One is that it gives you a quality to the image itself that's really kind of unbeatable. It's
big
like
negative.
Having a 1,000-megapixel camera in a way, right? There's that. The other thing is when you point a camera like that at somebody, they basically shut up and sit straight. You know what I mean? It's an occasion.
It's an all-business kind of piece of equipment. Yeah.
People respond to it in a really positive way, and they kind of marshal their best selves for the camera, which is pretty nice.
Mm-hmm.
So I was looking around backstage trying to find a place to set up, and there was no place. And then all of a sudden I saw there was a men's room, and there was a ladies' room, and then there was a room of undetermined sexuality. We didn't know. It was not designated, right? So kind of peeped in there tentatively and then decided to take it over. Nobody was in there. We took it over. And that became our studio, was this anybody's bathroom was our studio.
You hung some drapes and some curtains just to give yourself a backdrop,
Exactly.
Yeah.
But even on the sides, you still see the stalls.
Yes. But you did something else that day that really interested me. You did something, you promised the rock gods something called a one-click session.
Yep.
As a way to sort of entice them to come spend some time with you, Greg, what's a one-click session?
That was a little spur-of-the-moment thing. Basically, what happens when people are, particularly when celebrities are photographed, people are always begging for one more role. Oh, just let's keep going. Let's just do a little more. And I felt like it would be such a nice turnabout to just say one picture and to actually be done before they're done, right? And the way I got them in is it's just one frame, and you kind of really can't turn down one click.
Because these guys are tired of being photographed, at least many of them, right?
They've been shot to death.
And yeah, one more roll, and I don't want to do it anymore, right?
Right.
Yeah.
So this is just one frame. They came in, and in fact, they were ready for a second picture, but I was done. And in their case, we actually did shoot two pictures, and one ended up being the cover of Life, and the other one was the opening picture for the story.
But how do you – I mean, that's a lot of pressure. You were shooting for Life that day.
Mm-hmm.
So Life is notorious for role after role after role. What if they're blinking? What if you don't get the shot you got to have in your one click?
I would be in really, really, really big trouble.
Just gigs up.
Yeah.
I
have to pull my kids out of school. It would be very sad. Yeah.
Well, but that's an extraordinary amount of pressure, I would think.
It is. But in the moment, you're just thinking about the pictures. You're not worried about that kind of stuff. Really. You're not. It's just sort of like you want to get the best image you can, whatever it is, at that moment.
You know, you've been shooting these people for a long time. I mean, famous people, one after another, O.J. to Michael Bloomberg and everybody in between. And I'm wondering when Tina Turner and Mick Jagger sort of walk into the room, I mean, that's got to be something of a moment, right? I mean, that's for anybody, even a vet like you, that's got to be a moment.
It's pretty thrilling.
Oh,
I have to be honest.
Yeah.
And in a way, looking through the camera keeps it that little teeny bit unreal. Do you know what I mean? It's like I'm not actually standing next to them having dinner. I'm actually this one little camera, this kind of big camera actually, is between me and them. And it's this little shield in a way, a little bit of a shield.
Do you spend time in a hurry-up situation like that? Are you talking with them? Are you spending some time and small-talking or not?
Yeah, my dad was actually a salesman, so I sort of picked up like the salesman's patter from him. I can't help it. I just go into autopilot, and that's what happens. But in a situation like that, there's almost no time. So what you're doing is you're actually resorting to like almost miming, kind of mirroring what you want them to do.
Did you know what you wanted them to do?
It just shows up. What I wanted was a great pose, a great moment, a great response to the camera.
And they just did that sort of spontaneously for you.
The first one was kind of serious, and then I just sort of threw my head back and they did the exact same thing.
Yeah, you know, you talk about that a lot in the book. And again, great passage when it comes to former President George W. Bush. And you're shooting him again in the White House. You're back in the White House. And I'd never thought about this before, but he comes in and he says to you, again, I'm trying to recall these passages, but he says to you, I've got a lot on my mind. I mean, imagine that. The President of the United States, and he's, you know, you're taking up his time to shoot his portrait, and a guy from Texas probably isn't wild about having a portrait taken. But you talk about a technique you use to sort of get people to do what you like them to do, which is you sort of do something you want them to do. You sort of do it for them, sticking a hand in a pocket, sticking an arm on the back of a chair. And invariably, you say they'll do that. A lot of people will. The exception happened to be, in this case, George W. Bush wasn't following your lead by any stretch of the imagination.
The President of the United States was not picking up on the cues.
Yeah.
He was not picking up on
buddy,
the cues.
Come on, buddy. We're not
I put my hand in my pocket.
Here.
Nothing.
Yeah.
I crossed my arms. Nothing.
Yeah.
I took a deep breath. Nothing. And he did. He looked up at me and he said, a little bit kind of peeved. He said, you know, I got a lot on my mind. And I remember thinking, like, Well, I hope so.
That's the idea here,
you
right?
You are kind of the president. I don't know.
Yeah. So what did you do?
I basically went over and actually told him physically exactly what to do. Like, can you just lean here and have this hand in your pocket and just be relaxed like this and kind of step by step. And sometimes it comes down to saying, can you move up your left eyebrow a quarter of an inch? And it's physically almost like a mechanical process. And sometimes that's what works. And you just sort of have to figure out what's going to work today.
What finally relaxed him that day, do you think?
I don't know if he ever was relaxed. He looks relaxed, and that's what's key. Mm-hmm. And he's actually very affable in person. He really, really is.
Yes.
Very relaxed and very affable. So I think that in his case, it was just more a matter of him kind of relaxing into the situation. And I was joking and talking and, you know, going on a bit.
Yeah. Gregory Heisler is our guest again, one of this country's great portrait photographers. He has a new book, Gregory Heisler, 50 Portraits, talks a lot about not only the photographs themselves, but how he gets so many of these great shots. If you want to join our conversation this morning, 816-235-2888, our email address, updatedat@kcur.org. You can also tweet us at KCUR, UpToDate. Joni Mitchell.
It's love.
It is love. You write this, Greg, about Joni Mitchell. In another life, I'd have dropped to one knee and proposed on the spot. I was mesmerized. Joni Mitchell was warm, welcoming, conspiratorial, and game for our little portrait session. Oh, and did I say beautiful? Just beautiful. You shot her in a hat next to some flowers. Tell us about your time with Joni Mitchell. Because it's again, you see the photograph and it's like, oh, yeah. You know,
it's all just in a blissful haze for me now.
Yeah,
it is.
Yeah.
She lived in a beautiful home in Beverly Hills. She couldn't have been friendlier. She was just beautiful in person. She had this unbelievably charismatic smile. She was chain smoking and laughing and played us some of her latest music that she had just recorded. I mean, it's like we were the oldest friends ever. She was that open and welcoming, really. It was kind of remarkable. I was in heaven the whole day. And basically, I brought with sort of my favorite cameras, different cameras, to kind of be able to follow my muse that day. Sort of like, what if we tried something here? Let's try that. And she was like, yeah, that sounds good. Let's try that. You know, it was the opposite of trying to get the president to put his hand in his pocket.
Yeah.
This was the opposite of that.
It's so neat to hear those stories because as a print reporter for most of my career, every once in a while you'll have an interview and a time with somebody. It doesn't happen often when the thing just flows. The interview goes well. You can see your story. It's coming together and off you go. And it sounds like, Greg, you had moments like that too, Joni Mitchell being one of them.
Mm-hmm. It's rare when it happens, but boy, you sure welcome it when it does, like a little gift.
Yeah. O.J. Simpson.
Yeah. I mean, this was after the trial, and it was a cover and an opener. Opener is the picture that leads off a story. It was the opener for Esquire magazine, and I didn't know what to expect. I had this image that just popped into my head of him sitting alone at this table in a white void in a space. And I just felt like in the end, only he knows his own truth. There's a lot of controversy back and forth, obviously, yeah. But in the end, he's left with his own truth. And I sort of wanted this photograph of him. And it was a really weird thing. The night before the shoot,
Well, tell us what the publicist says to you.
Really, yes. He had sort of one of these sports lawyer agent kind of guys. And I asked him, you know, who's going to show up to the shoot? What's he going to be like?
Yeah.
He says, oh, the Juice Man, you're going to love him.
Yeah.
I was like, really? He says, yeah, you can't judge a guy by the worst night of his life.
You know, that quote staggered me.
I
couldn't believe he would say something like that.
Yeah, like it was the easiest, most normal thing ever, you know? And it was so very surprising. And O.J. came in and he couldn't have been friendlier.
Unaccompanied,
just strolled in.
Drove himself, yeah.
Yep, ready to get photographed. And I think the sense I got from him was like, there's nothing you can say that hasn't been said to me or about me. Like, knock yourself out. Give it your best shot. Go for it. I'm like, I'll do whatever you want.
Yeah, I was going to say, he was willing to do absolutely anything. And in this case, you had to pose him. You sort of have to see the photograph, but he's sitting at this table. There's a mirror in front of him. But the mirror is sort of out of kilter just a little bit, just to the right, because you wanted the camera needed to see his face in the mirror. And O.J., as a result, is sort of just looking straight ahead past the mirror, mm-hmm. to the left of the mirror, just into space, right?
Yep. And the notion is it's sort of like he's confronting him. It almost looks like he's visiting himself in prison in a funny way. Do you know what I mean?
It's one of those you visit a friend in prison.
Yep. It felt like that.
Did he see that photograph before he left that day?
That's a good question. We did shoot Polaroid tests of it. I couldn't swear. I'm not sure if he saw it or not. But again, I think he would have been fine with it.
Do your subjects ever see the photographs before they leave? Like in the day in Philadelphia when you're shooting Tina and Mick Jagger, did you see the photograph before they left? Did you know you had something?
No. There was
really?
No, because it was this one-shot deal. So there was no time to do a test picture. And it's not like with digital now where basically every picture you shoot pops up on the screen and everybody can have a look at it. And that can work for you or against you. I'm not a big sharing person when it comes down to that because I have so little time with my subjects. I feel like they'll ask. They'll say, oh, can I see the picture? And I say, no. They
yeah.
don't like that. And they say, well, why not? And I say, well, it's going to take a minute for you to look at it, 2 minutes to decide if you like it or not, another 2 minutes for you to explain it to me, and then you're gone. Like all we have is 5 minutes.
Yeah.
So you could have come in yesterday and we could have kicked it around, but basically you have to really trust me is what it comes down to. You just have to trust me on this one. And they're usually really good about it. Occasionally I'll share a photograph. I photographed ballet dancers. I remember one shoot, and it was crucial. It was really critical that I caught them at the exact right moment in their performance. And for that, I would show them the photograph to make sure I'm catching it where I need to be catching it, that kind of thing.
Hmm. How often in your career have you left a shoot and you didn't have it?
I'm going to sound like a terrible person, but never.
Don't say never. Come on.
No, it's true.
Just throw me one bone here.
I'll give you one.
Yeah.
I was actually talking about this last night. I had the one nightmare shoot of my whole career, one in particular that was just terrible. And it was a terrific portrait, like a perfect opportunity, like put in my lap with silk gloves. It was like a perfect thing. It was a portrait of Doris Day. Like, how nice is that to do, right? Picture of Doris Day. She couldn't have been nicer. Beautiful home we were photographing at in Carmel Valley in California. And I get to her house, and her housekeeper answers the door on a Saturday about noon. And the first thing she says is, oh, the other photographer's just finishing up. And I thought, the other photographer? So somebody had been photographing her all morning, and then it was my turn.
Oh.
And that just rattled me. It just completely freaked me out. And basically, I spent the entire day messing up one picture after – kind of missing one picture after another. And it was finally 8 o'clock at night, and I hadn't actually made a picture yet. I was stumbling over myself all day long. And I finally made a picture that was like an okay picture of her in her bedroom on her bed with her puppies, which was really nice. But I felt like I squandered – a golden opportunity that day. But even then, that's why I said never, because even then, I still came back with the goods. Like I can't, I cannot ever not have a picture. Like that's what being professional is.
Greg, I'm glad there was at least one story like that. Thanks for sharing that one with us. Yeah. Well, what a pleasure to have you. Thanks so much for coming in. And
thanks
congratulations
so much.
On just an absolutely stunning book.
Thank you so much for having me. It's really an honor
to be
here,
Steve. Gregory Heisler's book, 50 Portraits. He'll be speaking tonight about the evocative portrait at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art at 7 o'clock. More information at asmp-kc.org. We'll have a link to that on our website, kcur.org.